we say that these are great works that are worth our attention and worth rereading. So if we're right about that, this guff that we've told our students for nearly a decade, then none of us can leave this place unchanged, Malcolm.
I'm Malcolm Keating, and you're listening to Sutras and Stuff. Today on the podcast, how does encountering Indian philosophy make a difference in our thinking about the world around us? This episode is the second in a series of conversations with philosophers who have taught Indian philosophy at Yale and U.S. College in Singapore. It's an unusual liberal arts college where students first encounter philosophy through a global two-semester sequence that includes not just Indian philosophy, but also Chinese philosophy, Islamic philosophy, ancient Greek and Roman philosophy, and works from European traditions. Since this academic experiment is ending in 2025, I wanted to hear from professors who came to learn about Indian philosophy by teaching it in this global context. Most of them were experts in other areas of philosophy first. So, what did they learn from this experience? Did it change their understanding of themselves, of philosophy, or of the world?
I'm Andrew Bailey, and I teach philosophy, politics, and economics at Yale and U.S. College in the Division of Humanities. And in part of that involves teaching in our common curriculum, including the philosophy and political thought sequence.
According to Andrew's website, he thinks about money, about people, and about God. He's the author of Monotheism and Human Nature and 30-some philosophical articles in lots of journals. And he has a lot to say about Bitcoin. But when he joined Yale and U.S. in 2012...
My research was mostly in analytic metaphysics, which actually prepared me well for Nagarjuna, though I did not know it at the time.
Nagarjuna is one of the most famous and important early Buddhist philosophers. He's famous, or perhaps infamous, for writing a number of very difficult works that argue for the importance of emptiness, a metaphysical idea that has kept interpreters busy for thousands of years since the second century Common Era, when he wrote a book that Yale and U.S. students read in translation, the Mulamajjhimakkarika, or The Fundamental Wisdom of the Middle Way.
So I would say the first time I looked at the text, it was these impenetrable aphoristic verse things that I just couldn't, you bang your head up against them, I couldn't really figure out what was happening. But with a little bit of attention and the help of a community to read it together, and Jay's commentary in the back of the book.
Andrew's talking about Jay Garfield, who we'll hear from later this season.
I realized, in fact, Nagarjuna is doing something very, very much like analytic metaphysics. The difference is just the style, and maybe that some premises are suppressed.
A suppressed premise is just when a step in an argument is omitted, because maybe the person arguing thinks it's obvious and not important to mention. But also, Nagarjuna's book is written in verse, probably because it would have been memorized and discussed, so as to fill in the gaps. And the idea of a gap is a nice segue into thinking about emptiness. Because emptiness isn't just emptiness full stop, like a gap isn't just a gap full stop. Gaps are in or of something, a gap in the road or a gap in a bit of text. So it's the same way with emptiness. When Nagarjuna argues that everything is empty, he doesn't mean there's nothing at all that exists. He's saying everything is empty of something, and that something is intrinsic being or inherent existence. This gets into some deep metaphysical weeds, but the weeds have a structure when looked at closely.
I think Nagarjuna was trying to give a systematic picture of reality, or maybe in his case, a better word is non-reality, of what was not, what lacked intrinsic character or being, and to show how all phenomena were subject to the same destructive arguments. So for anything you could dream of, there's a simple argument that shows that it too lacks intrinsic being.
A destructive argument is a way of saying that Nagarjuna's goal was to hoist his opponents on their own petard. He's basically calling their bet. So he says, you think there's something unchangeable, which makes something what it is, some essence? Okay, let's see what consequences follow from that claim. Pick whatever you want. Universals like cowhood or fundamental atoms. He says, I'll show you that that idea leads to nonsense.
And when I think of the systematic programs of analytic metaphysicians like Peter Vannenwagen or David Lewis.
Van Inwagen still teaches at Notre Dame, and Lewis was at UCLA and Princeton just after the turn of the 21st century.
They have these little tricks they return to, and they apply them to many different phenomena to show that some systematic thesis about all of reality holds with some generality. Van Inwagen defends a two-category ontology, according to which, on the one hand, there are concrete particulars, and on the other, there are abstract objects of exactly one kind. He thinks there are assertibles. That's the only kind of abstract object there are. One question you might have is, wait a minute, aren't there other abstracta like numbers or propositions or possible worlds or Leibnizian intentions or various kinds of properties and relations? And what Van Inwagen does is he uses these little tricks to show that every single one of those is in fact just a special kind of assertible, where an assertible is something that is true or true of. So he's got this little trick, and then he shows that all this other stuff you thought you believed in could actually be collapsed down to one category. And I think what Nagarjuna does is he's got this one little trick to show that everything you believed in can be collapsed into no categories.
But these tricks, these arguments, can be dangerous. Nagarjuna's goal isn't just to figure out what does and doesn't exist, and how, but also to change our ideas about the world so we can remove suffering. And he says if we misunderstand him, there's a lot at stake. He compares the idea of emptiness to a snake. If you grasp it the wrong way, well, you'll get bit. However, if you manage to follow what Nagarjuna is saying, he thinks you'll understand that you don't have a self. You are empty of inherent existence. But that's just like the rest of reality. And for him, that realization is crucial for ending suffering. But for many of us, this idea is unusual, and maybe it even seems entirely implausible. Andrew, though, says it's become much more prominent in his own thinking as a metaphysician.
Perhaps 3/4 of my work in metaphysics has been about the nature of human persons. And an assumption in much of my work has been that there are such things as human persons. Is that assumption at odds with the no-self doctrine? Hard to say, in fact, hard to say. Should that doctrine be characterized as the view that we don't exist, as the view that we do not fundamentally exist, or as the view that we exist but only conventionally, or, you know, throw in some other adverb there? This is tough stuff. I never really thought about those questions. I simply assumed that I look in the mirror, there's a guy looking back at me, so of course I exist. Not so simple, every Buddhist would say. And I think I take that cautionary reply much more seriously now than I ever did, let's say, in graduate school.
So I asked Andrew if it would be fair to say that one of the impacts of reading and teaching Indian philosophy is not necessarily a direct line to resolving problems in his own research goals, but maybe something like challenging his assumptions and making him think about the fact that he has starting points and just where those starting points are.
That would be not only accurate, but more erudite than anything I said, so thank you. I'll give an example that has proven especially arresting for many of my students, and more recently for me, which is Gandhi's Hind Swaraj. This is a text that can often surprise students, and it certainly surprised me the first time I encountered it, which was the first time I taught it. It includes various anti-modernity screeds and mini essays about why lawyers are bad, why doctors are bad, why railroads are bad, why Parliament is bad, and why England is bad. And these are all taken to be symptoms of the disease of modern civilization, not true civilization. And I think what's surprising to at least readers who first encounter this is that on the face of it, they're inclined to think it's redonkulous. Of course, doctors are good because they save lives. Of course, railroads are good because they help us get places faster. But when we take a closer look at what these things have in common, why did Gandhi choose these as the things to critique, to find as troublesome enough symptoms of modernity to talk about, to dedicate a chapter to each in his little book, then I think students, surprise, to their own surprise, start to see something there that they didn't see at first, which is that, maybe our quest for convenience isn't doing us any favors. And once they see it in words like that, they start to notice their own quest for convenience in their own lives. Things like, what do smartphones do to your ability to pay attention to the people that you love, the people in front of you? What does the ability to order food on GrabFood do to your diet, to your relationship with food, to your knowledge of where it comes from and what it's doing to your body and to the earth? So internalities and externalities of your behavior. And then I think they say, wait a minute. No, maybe civilization is poison. Maybe there is something deeply spiritually harmful about convenience. I think that's what Gandhi was talking about. And one can disagree about a specific example, but if you canvass enough of them and see what they have in common, all of a sudden there's something here that in fact resonates with contemporary readers maybe more than ever before, at least for the readers who are paying attention. But that's my experience teaching the text, at least. And when I say, you know, readers looking at it first thought it was redonkulous, I'm not talking about my students. I'm talking about me. When I first saw the doctor's chapter, like, come on, dude, doctors are good. What are you saying? But no, it might well be that our ability to pump ourselves with insulin instead of changing diet, in fact, doesn't do us any favors, you know, as a treatment for diabetes, for example. So I'm not anti-doctor. I'm a doctor myself of a certain kind.
Gandhi's Hind Swaraj is one of the texts that students in Andrew's course encounter in the second semester when they begin to move from the pre-modern to the modern and think about connections between them. They start that second semester with a philosopher from the Nyaya tradition, one I talked about in season 2 of the podcast. His name is Anambhutta. He lived in the 17th century in southern India, and he was roughly contemporaneous with the European philosopher René Descartes. His little book, that is, Anambhutta's, is called the Tarka Samgraha, or the Primer on Objects Known by Reasoning, and it's supposed to introduce new students to Nyaya epistemology and metaphysics. But though it's an intro text, it's still pretty technical stuff. Andrew told me about his experience teaching this text recently.
This has been a tough text to teach the first 4 or 5 times that I taught it. Last year, I had a breakthrough. And I felt it was a top 5 teaching moment of all time. And I think the thing that helped me get there, it took me enough tries, God knows. I stopped trying to fit the text into any categories at all and let it breathe, so to speak. So here are some categories that I've tried and that failed. Thinking about it in terms of Venn diagrams, in terms of extensional logic or set theory or anything in that neighborhood. And what I realized was that not only was this not what Anambhutta was doing, but that trying to make it look like that, using more familiar tools to me, was keeping me from feeling any good feelings about the text. And students know that. They recognize that. If you're not enthusiastic, if you're not thoroughly in love with the text, they know it. And they won't be either, or at least an appreciable fraction of them will not. The median student won't. So what happened last year is that I asked students, how would you visually represent the difference between these kinds of provers?
If you want to know what provers are, listen to episode 3 of the second season. But here's a quick example. Smoke on a hill is a prover for the existence of fire on the hill. That's because where there's smoke, there's fire. Anambhutta starts here and quickly dives into more complex examples. When a prover is a genuine prover, like smoke, and when it fails to prove, and thereby we'd call it fallacious.
And how would you show that this one is fallacious, but that one is not? And they came up with things that were, you know, not always great, but always insightful and different than just a Venn diagram. And they fucking got it, man. They got it. And the thing that showed me that they got it was that the 1-minute papers I had them write afterwards, many of them gave examples of how this helped them slow down and notice things in their own thinking. And when you have an analytical tool that helps you notice things, that to me is almost always a sign of success. You have some concept, some bit of symbolism, some structure. And if you start to see it in the world and it helps you notice not just the structure, but notice the items within the structure, to notice things in your experience, that's usually good. It's kind of a mix of logic and epistemology in Anambhutta. But the students, dude, they noticed. They had this category in their head, and then they started to notice things in their own thinking. Like, yes, my thinking does have this structure. Maybe I skipped step four, but I do notice that I was using a prover or an example.
Yeah, it seems like one theme that I picked up in what we've been talking about is the importance of attention. So that came up in Gandhi, came up in Buddhist meditation, comes up here again. And this is something that I think the Indian traditions focus on in a wide range of ways, that they're about us attending to our cognitions and to the world in various, very skillful and I'd say sophisticated ways.
Actually, I'm surprised to hear you say that. I'm surprised to hear you make a generalization about the Indian tradition. Even that one, which is so modest and might be right.
It just doesn't seem like you. But yeah. it's a pretty good generalization as far as these go.
Yeah. Yeah. This podcast is about the Buddhist equivalent would be upaya, skillful means. There's skillful lies or heuristics which at least point you in the right direction. And I think that's probably one of them.
Maybe so. Maybe so. Noble.
Anyway, Andrew, thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it. It's been great hearing a little bit more about your experience of these texts from the inside. Even though we've been teaching together for years, we don't always sit down and have these kinds of conversations. So I appreciate it.
We used to. Yep. We're busy now. Yep. We have lots of things to do.
Yeah. All right. Thank you.
Groovy. Thanks, Malcolm.